How's everyone doing? I think we're going to go ahead and get started if you guys are up for it. And so here's my hope with this talk is just I've been spending a lot of time. I'm actually working on a manuscript on a book that comes out in March called Create Versus Copy. And it's really this whole idea of a theology of creativity. And what kind of precipitated it for me is simply this belief that we're all right now dealing with a real deep latent anxiety that we really don't know how to talk about. And what I mean by that latent anxiety is the world is moving too fast, globalization, mass communications. Hey, Tamara, did you get my text? No. She didn't get my text, which means she doesn't have the power cord. Thank you, hon. Just how fast and how quick the world is moving. I mean, I could give you a bunch of stats. They're in my book, The Grand Paradox, in one of the chapters. But how many years' worth of content is uploaded to YouTube every day? How all of us, if we have a smartphone, check it 150 times a day. Just the world is changing fast. 90% of the nonprofits in the world today were created in the last 10 years. I mean, just imagine that. If you work for a nonprofit, how do you compete for resources and donors? I mean, everybody has a friend who's in a nonprofit that's looking for money, you know? And as a pastor, how do you get people to tithe when all these nonprofits are doing a better job, really, of trying to go after donations? What does that really do to you? What do you do when the world is kind of at your doorstep? And so it's not just the hungry kids or the trafficked kids, but the race issues all around the world, or religious violence, or gender violence. Like, everything is so close, so ever-present in some sense, that it really causes this anxiety. How do I raise my kids in a culture like this? If you're a teacher, how do you integrate iPads into what you're doing? I mean, in elementary school in our town, every kid has an iPad now that the school district gives them. And they go home with. And so there's this kind of anxiety, I think, of how do you navigate modern life? How do you keep up? It's like Star Wars. You remember the original Star Wars when Han and Leia and Luke are in the trash compactor? Do you guys remember that? And the whole idea with the trash compactor is you're just pushing to keep up and to not get sucked under. So I kind of have this theory that we're all dealing with what one sociologist coined way back in the 70s, future shock, when the rate of change exceeds our ability to cope with it. That's what the phrase future shock meant. But that we're all really dealing with, in some sense, a PTSD of future shock. And that it's really happening. We're all experiencing it, but we don't know how to talk about it. So we know the stress at night when we're laying in bed. We know the stress when we're, you know, talking with spouses or kids. We know the stress of finance. We know all those things, but we really don't know how to process what's going on with us. And so starting with that, really wanting to say, I think the Holy Spirit always gives us what we need to live out God's will in our life and in our time. That somehow we're not without what God would want us to have in order to navigate our times. And so in looking at that, I really began to explore this idea of a theology of creativity. And my hypothesis is that creativity is one, I think there's several, but is one of the ways in which we're able to evolve or adapt and navigate the currents of modern life or very quick societal change. And so I think it's really important to learn kind of what's going on with this theology of creativity and then harness that moving forward. So we're going to jump right in, and here's where I get going with a theology of creativity. And basically, I'm not using theology in the boring sense. I want to use theology in the sense of how are we looking at things in conversation with God. So talking about our anxiety or the high rate of societal change in conversation with God, or God, how would I adapt or be creative? And we're doing that in conversation with God and trying to see what God would say into that. So thank you. I don't know if it's going to reach, but okay, thank you. So where we get started, and you can just look at the screen or you can turn there in your Bible, but this is a very famous passage. It's the passage where we get the idea of the image of God. If you think of the image of God, you're gonna think of probably Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel, and this whole idea of God animating man, kind of reaching out to him. It's interesting, during the Middle Ages, or really from the time of Greek and Roman art all the way till the Renaissance, we didn't paint God. It was a very Greek thing to do. The Greeks created statues of their gods. The Romans kind of copied their art. The Romans were great at military, but most of everything they did was copying. In art, they copied. In making up their gods, they just took the Greek gods and renamed them, you know, and kind of flipped it around. So you got Neptune and or Poseidon, and then Neptune, and you know, you just kind of. But the Greeks were copiers; they didn't really create much. But when Constantine legalized kind of all religions, and then a little bit later on, Christianity becomes the dominant religion. In the Christian mindset, you didn't want to depict God partly, and then you certainly didn't want to depict God nude, because, or anything nude, because that went against Christian sensibilities. So really, from the time of the late Roman period all the way through to the Renaissance, which was kind of the rebirth of these humanist ideas and the old Greco-Roman art forms, you didn't really have depictions of nudes in kind of the art world, and you certainly didn't have pictures of God. So that's why when we think of God the Father, we typically go right to Michelangelo, because it's really the dominant one that there is in the history of art, and certainly the one in the Western tradition that we would relate to the most. But so we get this idea, regardless of being made in the image of God, and what does that mean? When you take theology classes in seminary, you'll learn a lot of things. I mean, what are some things that are a part of the image of God? I mean, what are some ideas you might have? As you've heard it talked about by pastors or professors or whatnot, what is the image of God? What does that mean if we have God's image in us? Yeah.
The ability to say, I am.
Yeah. God certainly can say, I am, and then we find our being or our soulishness, our spirituality, by virtue of being made in the image of God. What's something else that might be part of the image of God?
Loving.
God is love. So if we're made in the image of God, that's actually, I think, one of the more dominant ones. I feel like we're playing Family Feud, you know, and the little thing turns, and ding, 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 that's the top one. Yeah.
Our ability to create and make
it grow. I don't like your answer because you're getting ahead of me. it's a really good answer. But any others? Just what does it mean to be made in the image of God?
Free will.
Free will. Is a big one. I would say rationality is one that you'll hear often, that we're rational creatures. We're not like some of the other creatures. We can think scientifically, that kind of thing. What's that? We speak things into existence. We have that same kind of language, and language is a huge thing. God's words carry power. The whole Tower of Babel kind of teaches us just really where language fits. Yeah.
We have value.
We have value, dignity. So, on Thursday when we talk about justice, that plays in huge. If we're going to talk about human rights, where do human rights come from? And they really come from us being made in the image of God, meaning we have inherent worth and dignity. And so therefore, because I have that dignity, you owe me something. You have a human responsibility because I have a human right. And if you have a human right, then I have a human responsibility. And therefore, we ought to treat each other in a sense where that dignity is valued. So that's a huge one. Another one, yeah.
Imagination.
You two, stop it. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and so we know what it is to want to make the world revolve around us. And that, in some sense, that's the original sin, is to usurp the place of God. Yeah. Relationship. So I would say that's probably one of the top four that I'll get when or that I studied or when I ask people. And so love is a huge one. Rationality and relationality is really huge. We're relational creatures. I mean, the idea of hell in Don Miller's famous book, Blue Like Jazz, was being in a spacesuit that kept you alive, floating around the earth, you know, in that solitary kind of position, right? That was kind of this metaphor for hell for him. And so we have all these different things. Ironically, she brought it up in the back, and you did as well. Imagination and creativity Never in all of the theology classes I took did that ever come up. It never came up for me. It was never taught. It was never in the books that I went and looked at, that we have human creativity because we've been made in the image of a creative God didn't come up. And so I wanted to just start with this verse and say, I find that really ironic that creativity never really jumps up, because if you look at this, what word shows up more than any other word in Genesis 1:27? Even the word God, I mean, you've got a he there, so I guess you could kind of cheat and say it's a tie, but and maybe God wins. But outside of the word God or the references for God, there's only one word that really shows up and dominates more than any other, and it's this idea of created. So if we were only going to take this verse, the verse that we get God made men and women in his image, and we're going to say what one thing must be made in the image of God necessarily include, what would we have to say? So we can argue about all these other attributes as being part of the image of God, but there's one thing at a grammatical necessity has to be a part of being made in the image of God. And that's that God is a creative being who created us in his image, and therefore we too must be creative beings who have the ability to create. Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm getting that? So my first part of a theology, there's going to be three parts, okay? But the first one is just this basic one, that to be human is to be creative. It's a really strange thing, because in society we tend to think that creatives are artists. And if you're artistic, then you're creative. And the stats are that about 10% of everyone in society has a certain gift. If we're taking Christian gifts, we would say that 10% of you probably have the gift of evangelism. And 10% of you probably have the gift of mercy, and 10% of you would have a gift of administration or something like that. And we tend to think that that 10%, those people that are truly artistic, they're creative. The rest of us, we're not creative. And so we go around kind of with this lie that creativity is for some people. It's exclusive. And what I'm going to argue is that creativity is actually a human trait, that we all have it. Which of you has ever delegated the naming of an animal to someone else? If you have kids, maybe, or other people in your family. Who's delegated, you know, week after week, your weekend plans? When someone asks you what you're passionate about, how many of you look at someone else and say, oh, why don't you come up with an answer? You probably have a much better answer than I do. There's certain things that we engage in creatively. Who makes up your bucket list? You or someone else? We're all naturally creative in some sense, and what I want to argue for is that we need to understand that, because that creativity is a capacity just like a muscle. Your rationality is a capacity just like a muscle. Your loving ability, is there anyone in here that can't love, that's incapable of love? But some of us do it better, and some of us next year, if we focused on it, might be able to love better than we are able to love now. It's a capacity, right? That if we exercise, we'll grow over time. So creativity is a human capacity. It's different than an artistic ability or gift. That's the first part of the theology. What that means is it means we also have imagination. And imagination is a beautiful thing about what it means to really explore how fully charged with spirituality all of life is. There's a phrase that I like. It's just everything is spiritual. Everything is spiritual. If you really thought about it, everything we're doing has a spiritual dimension. If we open our minds to it, everything is spiritual. A laugh, a smile, a touch, an act of service, the thoughts that you're thinking. If we really understand that there's a phrase, a God-haunted universe, then everything is spiritual in some sense. If we go beyond that, we get to, I think, some of my favorite authors like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien that really valued the imagination. And C.S. Lewis valued the imagination. He wrote about it in a little essay called Three Reasons for Children's Literature, or the Three Different Reasons for Writing Children's Literature. And he talked about the first two, and then he says, but here's the third, and that's the reason I write children's literature. And it was simply this. It's the best, oftentimes, the best genre for saying what needs to be said. So for C.S. Lewis, he was basically saying, as an adult that writes to adults and that wants to express deep truths, oftentimes fantasy or these children's genres, fairy tale, if you will, is the best vehicle for communicating deep truth. So for C.S. Lewis, the angels really are singing in the atmosphere right now. And these forests really are enchanted. I mean, if I walked you through the different stages of photosynthesis going on right now on these plants and these trees that have the light shining on them, and if I really talked about the weird thing whereby these trees have a memory somehow that every year at the same time they drop those leaves and they go into a bit of a hibernation, and then when the sun comes out and the temperatures get to a certain point, they begin to grow those leaves again. And that somehow all of this can start from acorns, and that all of what's possible can be reduced down to seeds and soil. And you really begin to talk about that, and you go, is it just a tree? Is it just a forest? You take that train on Wednesday to the down the Redwoods to Santa Cruz, and you really begin to think about what's going on. It's like, you know what? The language of magic and an enchanted forest might actually be a little bit more true or awaken our minds to a little bit more of the truth than if we just talked about that tree or that forest or this kind of tree, if you will. C.S. Lewis really wanted to kind of awaken in us the reality of what's going on. And so he thought that children's literature got at that better. And then he thought it was really unfortunate that modern education takes you from that imaginative state and makes you a little more dull as you grow up. So C.S. Lewis thought we matured our way out of kind of this robust way of imagining. So as we became older, we became more dull. And we lost our sensibility, and we lived in a very, what he would call, cold universe. And then his whole idea was that if we continue through that, we might begin in our older age to really realize, wow, there's something really deep and dynamic going on here. It really is worth a second look. And so in the introduction to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he writes his goddaughter, Lucy, who the main character gets her name from, Lucy Pevensey. So Lucy's named after Owen Barfield's daughter, Lucy. And Lewis kind of dedicates the book to her with, I think, my favorite dedication, except for the dedication I did to my wife in my first book, because she's sitting here. But my favorite of all time dedication in the beginning of a book is he says to her, may you grow old enough to read fairy tales once again. May you grow old enough to read fairy tales once again. So what Lewis is really saying is, in our old age, may we come back to the literature of fantasy, back to the literature of fairy tale, back to these stories, and in doing so, have our minds kind of awakened again to the beauty and the grandeur and the magic kind of the world, right? Imagination is such a part of creativity. Now, here's where it really comes in, and I think it's fascinating. There is a longitudinal study. So Sir Ken Robinson, who's kind of one of the foremost thinkers on creativity, he talks about this study, and he describes it. A longitudinal study is you're gonna take a sample group, and you're going to evaluate that same sample group over time. That's a longitudinal study. And they took these kindergartners, group of kindergartners, and they asked them a question that got at really imaginative thinking, but it's called divergent thinking. Divergent thinking would be, if I asked you the question, here's a paperclip, how many different uses can you think of for a paperclip, that your answers are a form of divergent thinking. It's like, well, there's the obvious one, you clip paper, but sometimes you can bend it, use it as a fish hook. You know, you might be able to use it as an earring if you want to be kind of cool. I mean, you just come up with imaginative answers, right? And the average person would come up with 10 to 12. If you were really good, you'd come up with in the range of 100 to 150. What if the paperclip was made out of concrete and it was 100 feet long and you could use it as a crane hook and you could hoist, you know, what if it was big enough that you could use it as an adapted anchor for a big boat? What if it was, you know, what if you made the chain for boats instead of links, you made them paper clips, one to the next, to the next, to the next. Like, divergent thinking is really being able to expand your mind and imagine different things. And if you're really good at that question, you get in the range of 100 to 150. Does that make sense? Okay. And if you're in that range, you are called genius. Okay. You are at the genius level of divergent thinking or imaginative thinking. So they tested these kindergartners. I think it was 500 of them. And do you want to know what percentage of those kindergartners tested in the genius level? Anyone have a guess? Who said 99? It's 98. You're a kindergarten teacher. Very good. Yeah. But you know what we're talking about here. So those kindergartners, man, they killed it. They could come up with all sorts of stuff, right? This is a way with this paperclip I could hurt my sister, you know, or my brother, you know, or a way I could. So 98% tested genius. 5 years later, the same kindergartners, and they dropped all the way down almost in half. 5 years again, dropped again, to the point where, so 5 years and then 5 years, wherever it was in their late teens, only a fraction of them were still testing at the genius level. And so you start here and you get to here, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Ken Robinson's where he wants to go with that and kind of his agenda is to look at education and to say we're doing something really strange. We're educating creativity out of people. And he'll want to look at modern education, which was really birthed in Enlightenment principles to serve industrialization needs, and saying that we got to rethink this now kind of in a modern world. But what we do with standardization is what? We teach everyone, how many answers are there for a question? One. And if you don't put just the right answer, you're what? Wrong. And so we teach them, and when you're wrong, you get a bad what? And it's good to get what grades? Good ones. And so everything keeps pointing you back to, we're going to give you a test, and you really need to know what answer to put to get the reward that's going to make you feel like you're a smart person, you know? So standardization really takes it down to one question, one answer. Now, why does that matter for our spiritual life? I titled this Imagination in the Pursuit of God. Think about it. God, I don't know how I'm going to pay the bills. So I'm going to come to you in prayer, and I'm going to tell you, God, I don't have money to pay the bills. I really need to be able to pay the bills. God, I need you to answer my prayer. What answer am I thinking of? Money sufficient enough to pay my bills. So unless God really puts money in my hand sufficient enough to pay my bills, I'm probably not going to recognize that he's answered my prayer. But how does God usually answer our prayers? Not at all in the way we're thinking. All of a sudden you get a new job opportunity, or your bill goes away, or you find a way to get into a lower interest loan with a big loan you had that all of a sudden lowers your overhead to where that deficit kind of goes away, or who knows what it could be, right? I mean, God has all of these all these different ways, his power can work in all these different ways to answer our questions or to solve our needs, or in a creative way, he might want you to go through that struggle to realize it's time to change your budget. Or he might want you to go through that and then realize that someone else is struggling with the same thing, and he wanted you to know what it felt like so that as you came along to kind of encourage or empathize with them, that you had the ability to know what that felt like. And then, boom, right afterwards, the money comes. Not when you wanted it, but certainly in time for you to meet your need. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. So the wisdom that Solomon had in terms of how to act in life in the best way to reach the greatest results. Because one of the interesting things is if you go back to that passage, Solomon asked for wisdom not as an end in itself, but as a means. We're not told this, by the way, in Sunday school class. What Solomon wanted was to be able to rule justly, and he says, I'm young and I don't know how to do it, so give me wisdom that I might be able to rule justly. So he sought wisdom for the purpose of justice so that things would flourish, which is really fascinating. We're going to tie back to that in a minute. So divergent thinking is not just a fun little game for analyzing kindergartners, but it's really speaking to our human capacity for imagination and creativity, not only in business, so web design. You know, there's not just one way to do it, but how could I attack this problem in different ways? And how can I come up with all sorts of different ones? And all of a sudden, I'm going to hit on an idea that really is an innovation and then allows me to help a Christian camp with their webpage in ways that I never thought of before. Because there's not just one way that I have to copy. I can create. That's where the whole title, Create versus Copy, comes in. But even in my prayer life and in my spiritual life, it's not just prayer and Bible study and going to church that make us Christians or develop our relationship with God. Those are certainly great disciplines, but we can get so much more creative than that, can't we? The way we spend time with other Christians, the way we interact with nature, the way we look at beauty and try and understand, God, what would you be telling me through nature, through beauty? Because if we go to Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. Night after night, they pour forth speech. There's content somehow in nature and in God's creation. So if we actually had the ears to hear, we would learn that there's things we can discern about our lives from nature. Jesus with his parables of nature and the seeds and the soils and stuff like that. So our imagination speaks volumes to our ability to know and understand God. So that's the first part of a theology of creativity, is this idea of inherent creativity as a part of being made in the image of God that we all have. I mean, is that a strange thought to you? Does it feel strange to anybody? If I say you are creative, I mean, is it a little bit strange? For some of us, it is. I think we've grown up in a culture that tells us we're not creative, that's other people. And I think it's a rich, deep spiritual thing to be able to lay hold of that idea that I've been made in the image of a creative God, and I've been endowed with creativity. I can grow old enough to read fairy tales once again. All right, here we go. Isaiah 54, verse 16. See, it is I who created the blacksmith, who fans the coals into flames and forges a weapon fit for its work. And it is I who have created the destroyer to wreak havoc. So these Israelites were worried about the weapons of war and what that was going to mean. Their fear was of the weapons of war. And what God is really saying is, you're missing the point here. I created the blacksmith. The blacksmith creates the weapons of war that you're so afraid about. But I sit over all of this sovereignly, actively creating for my purpose, for my ends, for my will. I didn't just create you at the beginning of time with Adam and Eve. I didn't just breathe life into you then, make you in my image. I'm still creating now in the present. This is what it means by God being the potter and we're the clay, is that God is actively creating even in the present. God creates when he answers your prayer. God creates when he moves things around to accomplish his will. God is creatively involved over the things we'd be afraid of. So your banker that holds the loan, it's not the loan you should fear. It's God who made the banker who holds the loan. The whatever it might be that you're afraid of, God sits over that. Does that make sense? And we look up and we go, God, ultimately you're in control of what's happening here. And you can create it this way or you can shape it that way. But I'm the clay and I'm in your hands. And if you want me to go through this trial, I'll go through this trial. If you want to lead me out of this trial, lead me out of this trial. But you are actively involved in the shaping of the world now. Not only now, but God says, see, I will create a new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. Be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create. For I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. So here's the second insight about a theology of creativity, is that God created, he is creating, and he will create. In other words, God's creativity extends through time. And if we're made in the image of a creative God and we're endowed with that same creativity, we have created in the past, we are creating now, and we will create in the future. So we can look at creativity as a part of our whole human narrative and our calling through time. We know this to be true of a theology of salvation or the doctrine of salvation. Who's ever heard it put this way, that God has saved you, is saving you, and will save you? You ever heard it put that way? It's a formal way of breaking out justification. When Jesus died for our sins, or when we took hold of that promise, we were justified in Christ. Does that make sense? Sanctification is the doctrine of salvation, whereby we're slowly being made into the image of Christ. And so that work is still ongoing in us in the present. And glorification is the word that we use in theology to talk about what will happen someday when we stand next to him in glory and we finally are like Christ. Our character has been perfected. Our desires, in some sense, have been perfected. And so a way of talking about salvation is that it happens through time. We have been justified, are being sanctified, will be glorified. So I was saved, am being saved, and will finally be saved. Does that make sense? Likewise, if we understand creativity and we break it into its kind of nuanced form, God was, or God did create, is creating, and will create. There's a lot of hope that we can take from that. In other words, God is sovereign over my now and over my future. I can look to him to be actively involved in bringing about the states of affairs that I'm going to him in prayer about. And even if I am afraid, like God might not answer my prayer, I can look and say, but your will be done, not mine. So like Jesus said, you know, take this cup from me, but if not, your will be done. So we can look at God and say, just like a creative individual, he has a purpose for what he's doing. Nothing is capricious. Nothing is random. So if you're not going to answer my prayer or shape it the way I want it to go, I can at least trust that as a creator, that you have an intention for what it is you're doing. I haven't been forgotten. I'm not lost. You haven't lost sight of me somewhere. That you understand all of that and you're shaping it to where it needs to go. And not only that, but I can act alongside you, God, in accomplishing your will. That I'm a co-creator in this world. You're going to go and be my witnesses. You're going to go be my hands and feet. As you help the least of these, it's as if you're loving me. There's this dynamic relationship. You said that we're relational beings. We're in this relationship where Christ is the head and we're the body of Christ, the incarnation, as it were, that continues through time. And we get to continue to act out what Christ came to do and to bring life into this world. So there's this beauty of creativity moving through time. And so to get back to where we're talking about theology of creativity is, you are creative, and your creativity extends through time. I call that continuous creativity, yeah.
That word in Genesis, when you talk about God creating, is that word ever used, I think it's B-A-R, is that ever used for humans? Because I thought that word is like you're creating something from nothing, and we really can't do that.
Well, we have the phrase ex nihilo that we talk about with God, and in theology we say God's the only one that ever created ex nihilo, out of nothing. But even God takes the dirt and breathes life into it, which is very similar to the idea of when we're creating, we're taking the knowledge, our relationships, our past experiences, and we're bringing those ingredients together to make life in a way that there wasn't before. And so there's something that very much resembles, again, in the image of God, resembles God's creativity, even if that act of creating out of nothing is an act that we can't replicate. So God's first creative act was followed by successive creative acts as he takes and moves things around, separates light from dark and whatnot. And so working with what is there is the kind of creativity we do, and that's certainly taken account for in this. So real quickly, we'll move along, and it gets to some of these things. You are creative. If there's any one thing I really want to hammer home is when you walk out of here, that you can just say to yourself, I'm creative. I might not have been affirmed that way when I was growing up, but I have creativity and I can fan the flames of my imagination. Not only can I, but I should. And continuous creativity, that creativity isn't something you do once. Creativity is a mindset. It's something that extends through time. When I come up at that obstacle down the road on the horizon, I can begin to trust that God has given me the creativity sufficient enough to know how to navigate through that. Something I can begin to build in myself, this mindset. The third thing is this, and it really has to do with the aim of creativity, the end of creativity. If God made us creative in his image, God has an end or a purpose to all things. It's the reconciliation of all things. It's the shalom of all things. It's the righteousness and justice of all things. And when we're leaning into our God-given creativity, there's a way to actually evaluate different creative acts. Creativity is good, but not all creative acts are the same. Creativity can be used to destroy, right? Or it can be used to build up. And so we have to have, in some sense, a standard or a way of evaluating different instances of creativity that steer us ultimately how to use this tool in the way that it's supposed to be. So I met a man in Australia. I was speaking at a conference down there, and he's a theologian. He's in his late 50s. He's a South African by birth. And a white South African, and he was an Afrikaner at some point, and then fought against apartheid later on as he began to realize kind of what was so horrendous about what was happening with the race policies down there. And now he works as an educator in Australia and helps a lot with Aboriginal issues and the problems they have down there. And we were actually wine tasting outside of Melbourne and spent the whole day together, and was talking about my new book on this theology of creativity, and he started laughing and said, "Wow, you're the first person I've ever heard use that phrase other than myself. I love, for 20 years I've been using this phrase, the theology of creativity." And he says, "Well, how do you form up your theology?" And I'm like, "Well, I go to Genesis 1:27, and here's where I go." And he goes, "Oh, I go to the beginning. I think I got the verse here." He goes, "I go to Genesis 1:1. And it was just this fascinating conversation how we've kind of navigated these things differently. But what I really loved was, after hearing what he had to say, that he really gave a third strand to my theology of creativity, or what I'm trying to do with this theology. And what he gave to it was kind of the identity or the purpose part of it. So he comes to Genesis 1:1 and he says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And he separated out light from dark, and you know, he kind of spoke into nothing. And so if you read the whole thing, actually the first 11 verses cash it all out. So here it is. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light and was good. And he separated light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening, and there was morning on the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate the water from water." So God made the expanse, and he separated the waters. And so it continues on, but what Vainant wanted to say was, this guy's name is Vainant Dekak, and what Vainant wanted to say was, the first act of God's creativity was to make space for life. So much like an artist, their first act of creativity is to prepare a canvas, if you will. The first act of a teacher is to create a classroom. And you have an intentionality about creating that space, don't you? That this space is what's going to be needed, where people are actually going to be able to learn, little children are actually going to be able to learn and to grow and to flourish. And so what Vaina wanted to say is, the first thing of creativity is really to make space for life. And that really speaks to the aim of creativity, that God made us creative so that we could be involved in the reconciliation of all things, so that we could work for the flourishing of life. So if you just think of any job, it has its negative and its positive. A doctor exists to make space for life. If it's done well, they're breathing life into things. If it's done poorly, they're abusing people. A pharmacy company, a drug company. If it's done well, they're bringing life-saving solutions to people to make space for life. If it's done poorly, they're testing their drugs on poor people or in third world countries and hurting those in the interest of profit or money. A lawyer is meant to come alongside you to help for justice or to make sure you get a fair hearing, and they're really coming along to help make sure that happens, to make space for life. But if they're just caring about the economics of it or twisting the system, that's where all the lawyer jokes come in, right? That's the negative version of it. Educators exist to make space for life. If they don't do that, they're not really educating. They're just punching a clock or just trying to skirt around it, but they don't really care about breathing life into the students that are in front of them. As parents, we make space for life. It doesn't matter what it is. We can just keep going through it. Politics. The Greek word polis for city, a politician is someone who's supposed to be involved in the affairs of the city to bring about the greatest common good for the city. So politics even has this idea of making space for life in the good sense. And if you look at the bad sense, it's saying I'm not serving the interests of the common good. I'm really serving my own interests. And so we all, whatever it is, you can almost break down any kind of engineering, any kind of anything, and say that it always aims at goodness. It always aims at flourishing. And creativity is when we use our imagination and we use that God-given ability to come at our job or our vocation or our responsibilities, parents, or whatever it might be, to say, I'm going to make space for life. This has a lot to do with justice as well. For Vaynant, he said, you know, he wanted to talk about the Aboriginal issues, and it all has to do with land and the forced removal of Aboriginal communities from their lands, where they'd lived for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and their connection with the land. That when you want to look at justice and things flourishing, land's an incredibly important part. When you want to look at injustice and the harming of communities, depriving them of land is an incredibly important thing to look at. The laws of apartheid, I have a couple pictures. So the essence of creativity is to make space for life. So here's apartheid, right? Where you force people into townships and you're saying that you we're going to restrict your location. You can't use this water fountain. You can't go in these places. You can't hold these kinds of jobs. And so we're going to deprive you of that freedom to go where you would flourish the most. And so there's an injustice that comes about there. There's a harm to the flourishing. This is the one in Australia. Stop the closure, the forced closure of Aboriginal communities. And I could get into that and all the politics around it. But it's basically when you want to look at these issues of justice, land becomes an incredibly important thing. Why is it that the poor always live downstream, right? Why is it that sometimes when we do urban renewal, which everyone loves, downtown areas that now have the coffee shops, that when you really look at what's happening, there's poor communities in gentrification that get forced out of places where they've lived for generations because a developer wants to come in, pays high dollar to buy up a whole neighborhood, and then forces them out. I'm not getting into capitalism or anything like that, or whether if you own land, you should be able to move out renters, but there's issues about what we're doing with human beings and saying, are we paying attention to their life and trying to creatively make sure that we make space for life? Instead of just moving people out because they're poor or they don't have a voice. Gentrification, by the way, is a term that just means when the gentry, so it was coined back when the rich people or the gentry, the upper class, came into an area and it moved out the lower classes. And so a lot of the urban renewal that's going on in big cities around the country, Portland's one of them, the Pearl District, gentrification is really when you've got wealthy 20-something hipsters that want to live an urban lifestyle in kind of a condo, that there becomes an economic engine for supplying that, and then a lot of poor families or single moms with kids or whatever it might be that were in those areas for generations when nobody cared about them and they were slums that now get kind of pushed out. You see what I'm saying? Now, it doesn't mean you can't do that, but what would imagination say? What would a Christian imagination say? How do we take care of people at the same time we're pursuing our economic interests? What if, in pursuing our economic interests, we actually created space for these people to live so that they benefit as well as these, you know, the urban renewal projects or the people that are moving in? What would it look like if we actually used our creativity to make sure that we weren't committing injustices against anybody? Food chains and supply chains, the fact that a lot of American fish comes from Thailand and that there's some 500, I forget the stats, but a lot of the Thai fishing boats now that are, it's like the old term, you've been shanghaied, that people will be drugged and wake up on a fishing boat usually migrants that are stateless people. They've been born somewhere where no one wants to claim them, so they actually don't have citizenship in any country, and they're trying to figure out where they can live and work, and all of a sudden they wake up one night, and they're on a fishing boat, and they're out there for years, quite possibly going to die out there, and that these are the subsidiaries of bigger fishing companies that fish and then sell up, and then a lot of our supply chain comes from this. So when I'm looking at food that's going to make space for life for me or make space for life for my family, that there's a really problematic thing that if in the chain of that, that I'm actually benefiting at the expense of someone else where life is being deprived. So that's why in this globalized world, it's a really interesting thing. What would it say for businesses to learn how to creatively clean up supply chains? What would it look like for us as Christians to say, I'm not going to become I don't have to become a radical, a liberal, or a tree hugger, but how would I use my creativity to make recycling fun for family or to find projects where we're trying to cook in different ways and explore different things? Those are some justice-angled ones, but it really comes down to even things like disciplining kids. We do a rites of passage for our kids at age 11, and at that age, we tell them, you're now an adult in training. You're not a kid anymore. And it's kind of off of a whole biblical motif. The bar mitzvah idea was literally son of a commandment. So bar, like Barnabas, meant son of encouragement. So bar mitzvah is kind of the commands or the laws. So when you go through a bar mitzvah as a Jewish kid, you're basically coming out from underneath your father, and you're becoming accountable to the law. And so you're becoming an adult, basically. You're sitting underneath God's laws. And so an age of accountability is taking our kids and saying, we want you to be able to transition to where you feel the weight of that responsibility to begin to grow into that. And so it's really hard for us. We have to change the way we operate with our kids. And so it's, you know, at age, our oldest now is about to turn 14, but there's times when something frustrates me so much, but I have to ask that question, like, is what she needs the conversation at an adult level of saying, hey, you know you messed up, right? Yeah, Dad, I know. Do you want to handle this one yourself? Like, do you want to work your way out of this one? Yeah, Dad, just let me handle it. Okay, that's okay. Instead of me coming down on her, giving her the room to move, to make space for life. So it's a creativity even in how you discipline. You know, it doesn't take a lot of creativity to always react in the way that comes most natural, to clamp down, to yell, to get frustrated, which I still do a lot, by the way. But in my better moments, it's using my imagination to say, how do I equip and mentor my daughter in ways that are going to let the light bulbs come on so that she really begins to understand what adulthood means and responsibility means, and so that she can go out and learn how to navigate life with her own creativity, not always feeling like Dad's laws are kind of driving her forward. And so it's really affirming that ability for her to know how to navigate her own life. So this idea of making space for life as we come into different areas of responsibility really becomes a way of how we can see what creativity aims at. Does that make sense? So you are creative. Creativity extends through time, and creativity has an end. Your creativity, when you're leveraging it, ought to be something that makes room for people to live, that creates space. And that whole phrase of creating space, I think, is a beautiful one. The dinner table. When we're really creating meals and setting the table, what are we doing? That's the quintessential picture of goodness. Any Hollywood movie, when they get to the end, and if they really want to speak to somehow it's the Hollywood ending, somehow goodness has come about, they always end on a table. Even the Fast and the Furious number 4 or 5, they're in the backyard of Dominic Toretto, and they all come around the table, and they share a prayer, and they hold hands, kind of all these friends that drive cars too fast, right? But it's like, oh, this is family. Or it's the dramatic movie that finally comes to the holidays and things have been reconciled, and now you have this, the lights are low and you see the light twinkling off of the glass and the soundtrack kind of comes up and you see people laughing and talking, but you can't even hear what they're saying. All you see is just that goodness and that happiness of the table. Does that make sense? And that table really is a metaphor or a picture, I think, of all goodness. The psalm that says, you have set a table for me in the presence of my enemies. Meaning that somehow, even in the bad of all of life, enemies are about as bad as it gets, that God is always working for goodness, and he's even setting a table where things can be healthy and good, right despite the fact that I've got enemies on the outside of the gates, that you create a table for me in the presence of my enemies. So your creativity extends through time. There's this beautiful picture of creating space or making space for life to happen. And that when you harness that imagination, you harness that creativity, that you might be able to do your vocation better, that you might be able to envision whether web making or being a fireman or a policeman or a pastor and going, you know what? In all of what I'm doing, what I'm really working for is the reconciliation of all things, creating space, making space for people to live and to flourish, that we would all know the goodness and the fullness of God. And so creativity has an aim, and we can evaluate different acts of creativity and steer it in a certain direction. So those are three things, creative, through time, making space for life, and I tie them in the book I'm working on to imagination, intentional creativity, and innovation. So if you want to take them into the realm of practical, so out of theology into a realm of practical, so you're going to go back to your classroom. You're thinking about imagination, which is pure creativity, intentional creativity, which is focusing it on a problem or circumstances or challenges, and then ultimately innovation, which is filtering through your different acts of creativity or imagination so that you can bring them to bear on real-world problems in a way that works. When Jesus was asked about himself, he kind of takes a shot at the Pharisees, and he says, I am the good shepherd. I'm the good shepherd. My sheep know my name, they're healthy, all these kinds of things. What he was basically saying is you can look at the results of these sheep and know that I'm good. I'm not just claiming that I'm good because it's some title that I have. I'm pointing to the evidence of my goodness. I'm a good shepherd because my flock is healthy. And so innovation, again, imagination, intentional creativity, and innovation. Innovation is when we can point to something and say, I've brought my creativity to bear on a situation, and I can point to the flourishing. I can point to how it's brought about positive changes for communities, for cities, for families, for individuals, so that they may grow, so that they may thrive and flourish, so that they can know the shalom, that goodness that God wants for them. So those are kind of how you can move it from theology to practical. And there's a lot of different ways we can make creativity a habit and grow our creativity. And I'll save that for a different time. I'll allow some Q&A. But if you really want to go, okay, that sounds great. How do I become more creative? There's a lot of things you can do, by the way. And usually it's the same things that the Alzheimer's Association would recommend to avoid Alzheimer's. It's really an exercising of the brain and the imagination and creating new divergent ways of thinking. And so there's a lot in common. Dorothy Sayers, this great quote, I don't have... she says, we are never more fully alive than when we are creating. Dorothy Sayers. Man is never more fully alive than when he is creating. And so I think what you see with that vicious disease of Alzheimer's, which we know robs people of dignity, that if you put that on one end of a spectrum and you say what would be on the other end of the spectrum, the fullness of dignity is when we're fully living into that imagination and creativity that allows us to shape life. So it's a really fascinating thing. So I'll take questions. I think we got time for about three or four, and then we'll kick off to lunch. But any questions, thoughts? Yeah. Thank you. I just turned in the manuscript yesterday. But the date that it's supposed to come out is in March. And it's just a 30,000-word book, really short. It's meant to be very quick and readable, with a lot of practical ways of growing creativity in you. And it's really aimed at teachers, parents, moms, dads, not just leaders or business people. And it's called Create versus Copy. Create versus Copy. And so I say that in the book, there's two kinds of people in this world, those who create and those who copy. And by the way, we know that it's impossible to get away from copying, right? One of the ways kids learn to do something is by mimicking. You know, I mean, copying is a natural part of the building blocks of a lot of what we do. What I'm talking about is a mindset. that says I'm not going to confine myself just to replicating and not dreaming or not imagining how God could change what I'm seeing in front of me or what I've known before. So it's really this creative mindset of valuing imagination. I worked at a church in California where the children's director had a rule that nothing could be in the kids' ministry that had to do with imagination because it was false. Only what was biblical and true could be in the kids' ministry. And I remember when I heard that just being shocked and thinking that I had this picture go through my mind of her and C.S. Lewis in a boxing ring going 10 rounds, you know, and just thinking, you know, Lewis would roll over in his grave. He once got a letter from a mom saying, help, what do I do? My son loves Aslan and doesn't like Jesus. And C.S. Lewis wrote her back and said, actually, what he loves in Aslan is the characteristics of Jesus. What he loves in Aslan is Jesus. And you watch through time, as he grows older, he'll come to a deep and abiding love of Jesus because Jesus is what he was able to grab hold of in his imagination with Aslan. And so he says, you're doing great. You don't need to worry about anything. You know, so C.S. Lewis really believed imagination played such a profound role in shaping us as well as helping us behold the wonders of God or all of what God might want to interact with us about instead of putting the blinders on. So create versus copy is just saying we want to be the kinds of people that aren't going to have a copy mindset, but that we're going to come at life creatively, a life of possibility, right? So, yeah.
Is your quote from Sarah's from Mind of the Maker?
I think so, yeah.
That's what you all want to read until this book comes out.
Yeah, so Dorothy Sayers was one of, you know, in Lewis's kind of little entourage, if you will. Before they had the word entourage, he had an entourage. And Tolkien was. And Tolkien, his most written about book outside of the Lord of the Rings trilogy is an essay he did called On Fairy Stories. And it's literally, if you get into Tolkien scholarship, the most interacted, cited, referenced work that he did. And it's a seminal piece on this whole idea of the relationship of fairy stories and kind of our human makeup. Called On Fairy Stories. It's a bit of a meaty read, but it's worth it. And then another one who's really good in this area is Madeline L'Engle. If you've heard of Madeline L'Engle, she wrote a whole series, Wrinkle in Time series, that's great for kids. And I forget the one that, Walking on Water, I forget the one I'm trying to think of that's more of her nonfiction that works in this area of artistry and creativity. But she'd be another great author to go see. Yeah. What happened in my childhood that would have fostered a love of creativity? I think the biggest thing for me was travel. This is what we're trying to replicate in my kids' life, our kids' life. My parents didn't have it, but I have a theology of memory making. I'll give it to you real quick in a nutshell. But I feel like there's 12 dominant childhood memories that I made this number up, by the way. But I feel like there's 12 dominant childhood memories everyone's going to have. The broken elbow. The divorce, whatever it might be, the teacher in second grade that inspired you to love, whatever. But there's 12 dominant childhood memories. Some of those you can't control, like the car wreck, you know, or the bully in school or whatnot. I believe that as a parent, I can control half of those, and I've claimed them. They're mine. So 6, I just can't control, but the other 6 through intentionality and creativity, I can control. So I want to speak those other half dozen memories into my kids' lives. And the way to do that is by memory making. And the best way to make memories is tradition. Because things that happen through time cut really deep grooves. So it's the way you do Christmas that's the same every year with the egg omelet. You know, it's the way you do vacations and really, you know, create those memories with family or something like that. It's the way. We do half birthdays. I take my daughters out on a date on their birthday and their half birthday. We made up half birthdays. Never had heard it, but I thought I only get, you know, from the time they're 5 to 18 so many years, and I'm trying to shape a memory that would be one of those dominant memories, and that it would be a memory of them with their dad and kind of that really like intimate situation. And I needed more than one a year. And so we celebrate half birthdays. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that they realized that nobody else did that. You know, like we're going to Red Robin and they're expecting songs and little, you know, and it's like not for your half birthday, you know. But so here's the thing. Travel was what my parents did. My dad was in the Navy, and my earliest memories are European memories. So I was 3 to 6 years old in Holland. So my earliest childhood memories are all from Europe and traveling through Europe. And I think different languages and different stuff and art and city and culture. And I would say probably more than anything, I learn and dream as I get out in space and experience different things. So I would say travel is a huge part of it. One last question, yeah. Yeah, that's a big one these days, isn't it? I think if we believe in God and we're created in His image and we're created for a purpose, then God defines flourishing, at least sets the skeleton for it, right? Society really wants to define it now that says we're going to define what flourishing is. And the way they're defining it is basically anything you want or anything that makes you happy is going to be flourishing. Ironically, that's very much at odds from classical thinking. Aristotle wrote a whole book called Eudaimonian Ethics where he talks about happiness comes through virtue over time. So Aristotle thought older people had a better chance at being happy because you've had more time to shape your character and your virtue. And so most of classical thinking would have tied flourishing to virtue. Most of antiquity, both Christian and non-Christian, would have tied it to kind of some sort of virtuous living. And it's only in America with our really radical sense of freedom or autonomy. It's a real destructive individualism that we hold in this country. Anything goes for you as long as you don't hurt somebody else. And hurt somebody else is a really hard thing to prove. And so we're just going to let you do whatever you want, you know, unless it's directly harming someone like smoking in front of them. I mean, notice how quick it changed, right? Smoking, you can do it because you're free. The minute we get the studies that say long-term smoke hurts people, boom, within a couple years, gone, right? So the only thing that ever limits freedom in America is harm, like direct physical harm. And so we've just got a little bit of a runaway sense of freedom. And so I think we need to recover a little bit more of why were we created, what were we created for, what does it mean to live in harmony with our fellow man, and let God define that. But that's really the tension of the world. What St. Augustine said was the city of God and the city of man. That's his seminal work. So that's always been the age-old kind of debate. It's a very good question. Yep, sounds good. Lunch it is. Appreciate you guys sticking around. And I'll stick around for a few minutes if you have any more questions, and we'll see you on Thursday.